A Series A is a crucial moment for every venture-backed business. Raising this round is a turning point for startups, from validation to scale. So at our most recent Vamos Latam Summit, we invited investors from Latitude Ventures, Canary, Valor Capital Group, and FinTech Collective to share their perspectives on the path to a Series A. By the way, you can already click the link in the description to pre-register for our next incredible edition of VLS. In this episode, Thomas Roggio, Carlos Torres, Marcos Toleo, and Antoine Colasso talk about the state of early and late stage fundraising in LATAM in 2023 and 24, the metrics and milestones VCs take into consideration at the Series A stage, and the perspective for downstream capital in LATAM from Series B onward. My name is Brian Reckworth, and this is Latitude Podcast. Vamos LATAM.
Thanks for being here. Just get into it. And I think it's interesting. Today we have different perspectives about Series A, right? Marcos at Canary, one of the leading seed funds in Brazil, then helping, and LATAM helping your companies raising Series A's. Antoine, one of the OGs and leading seed and Series A funds in LATAM. So you have a different perspective in a way to Canary. And then Carlos as a US-based fund focused on fintech. Also, it will be interesting to get your perspective on the Series A prospects for Latin American companies. So to begin with, let's start with a very easy one. We've been in a rough context. Markets went sour now a year and a half ago. I would love to get your perspectives in terms of how you're seeing the current context. Where do you see it going in the near future? Let's start maybe with Carlos on my left.
Sure. Well, thanks again for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. We talk about the current context. I think we can see it in an optimistic note. No, I think this is a bit of a US-centric perspective. No, but I think if we look at where things were at the beginning of the year, inflation looks like the Fed has broken the back of it, hopefully, or has made meaningful progress. I think if you look at unemployment, right, we remain near record lows. And I think business confidence numbers are looking better. Growth projections for GDP have also improved. Clearly, if you look at some data out of Europe, things don't look as encouraging, primarily Germany. And I think that if you, of course, look at the Chinese situation, which I'm not an expert in, you know, there's many question marks that arise. But the reality is, I think things certainly are looking better. From a dry powder perspective, you know, we're at record levels, right? So I think for our industry, there's reason to be cautiously optimistic, at least.
Thank you. I have a question about dry powder, but let's keep it till later. Antoine?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting time right now. I think we are in a period, I think you mentioned the macro situation, economic situation, I think is absolutely right. I think we're seeing some positive signs in the U.S. Even Brazil has brought their interest rates down slightly, you know, starting to reduce them. Europe, I think, is still farther away in a lot of ways. UK is going to face some very big difficulties. So on a global scale, I think we're still, there's no single direction that everything is going right now. If you look at our markets and if you look at startups and venture, I think we're starting to see more activity right now, which is positive. But we're still working through things, I think. And so we haven't gotten through the bulk of companies have been focused very much on profitability, break even, things like that, which is the right thing. We went through the 2021 exuberance. We've gone through a lot of cost cutting, trying to hit that break even point. We're not there yet. And I think a lot of companies still have to face the idea of, okay, we're going to hit break even, but now how do we grow? So we're still in that phase where we're still trying to figure out. There's been a lot of follow-ons internal led rounds to get companies to make it through the period. But I don't think we know where those companies are going to come out on all cases yet. Early stage, I think you're seeing a lot more companies being created, which is a good thing. But I think later stage, we're still trying to see that. We've seen some exit activity in the US in IPOs. So we saw Arm go out. We saw Instacart go out. They had pops. They've come down below their IPO prices now. So we're still not at the point where things are totally comfortable. There is some liquidity for IPOs, I think, out there. So I think we're still in a phase of uncertainty, better than we were 6 months ago, but we're still in some phases of uncertainty, and it's different by different segments of the market, I would say.
Thanks. What was your perspective?
Sure. First, you know, thanks for inviting me. You know, very happy to be here and also happy investor of you guys. So great to be here. You know, I totally agree with you. It's an interesting or a strange, you know, time because I would argue that for the region here, we are living a liquidity crisis, but not a demand constraint crisis. So the companies are actually growing. So when we look at our, you know, top 10 companies within our portfolios, most of them are, you know, growing actually three digits, you know, since 21 in terms of top level, top line. So what is happening is, you know, I would separate in two cohorts. When we're talking about companies in the Series B plus, you know, onwards, most of them were able to raise money during 2021 or 20. They were able to cut costs, and also they're growing the top line. So they're cheaper, let's say, in terms of multiple. And they're, you know, either break even or they're with an M&A agenda. So they have plenty of cash. And then when it comes to the early stage, as Antoine said, we are actually seeing, as we are very active in being the first institutional money in, that's basically what we do. We're not leading the next round. We're just leading the first one. When it comes to the first one, we continue to see people building businesses. We invested in one company per month this year already. And when it comes to subsequent rounds, we had more than two subsequent rounds per month within our portfolio. So, you know, led by other funds.
So across the company portfolio, you're seeing two subsequent rounds, Series A's or Series B's?
Yeah, mostly A's. Yeah, mostly A's. So that's my point. So when you separate the B's onwards, they're not raising because, you know, the activity is quite muted. But when it comes to the early stage, we're seeing actually pretty healthy activity, of course, in lower levels than we used to see, but actually, you know, it's happening.
That makes sense. And then, yeah, from the Latitude Ventures perspective, which maybe we come even earlier than you with a smaller check, we're seeing activity in terms of good teams starting companies, many of them getting excited with AI and its possibilities after a couple of years. I had a quick question on the dry powder. So many founders literally ask us, okay, we have pretty good traction. Should we raise our round now in Q4 before Thanksgiving stops everything in the US? Or should we wait for a couple of quarters in Q1 and Q2? Do you think things are getting better? And there, I think there's some tailwinds, some headwinds. Dry powder is true, right? But like they have a mandate, the funds to invest that. And then I think for those same funds to raise their new vehicles, it will be probably a trickier market. So where do you fall in terms of that timeline, if you want, for founders raising, let's say, Series A's? That's our topic today.
Well, I think I said I was optimistic, but cautiously so, right? So I think the perspectives that they brought up are incredibly valid and true. I think that, look, there's many things that could derail the positive overall trajectory that we're seeing, right? Relative to maybe what was expected. So by no means is it deterministic that 2024 will continue to look better. So I think that in that sense, I think we're still in an environment where if you can secure money, right, funding and extend your lifeline at a cost that makes sense, I think that's an important if. I think it's still broadly as a rule of thumb, a good idea. But, you know, I always struggle with this question because it's always very relative to the company, right? I think at the end of the day, raising money, right, saying this as a VC, maybe, you know, is shooting myself in the foot, no, but it's an exercise of dilution for the founding team, right? It does come at a real cost. It's a real trade-off to the growth that you envision that you can fuel with that dilution trade-off in X period of time to generate X value, right? And it's always a calculation that depends very much on the circumstances of a company and the priorities of that founding team, right? So I think, you know, having a general answer to the question is always tricky. But with that said, yes, probably still a good idea to get your hands on some money if you can at good terms.
Any comments on this point?
No, I would just say to your question regarding kind of funds needing to invest and so on, I do think that LPs are allowing longer time period to invest in some ways. I think the time to invest, the investment period of funds shortened quite dramatically up until 2021, right? It was started off as 4 years, became three, became two in some cases, right? Now it's going back to closer to that four. So you do have that window. But I do also think that, there's no one answer to when should a company go out. It all depends on where the company is, how they're doing, what the valuation they can get for the right valuation. I mean, look, multiples have come down very clearly, starting from the public markets down to the private markets. And so founders need to be realistic about valuation for their company and then what size of round they can get and what kind of dilution that will mean. So it all depends on each company's situation.
Makes sense. I'll just add, as I said previously, you know, we saw almost 20 subsequent rounds this year. Most of those were actually pretty good rounds. You know, we just one was a down round, and the other 19 were, you know, up rounds. But of course, the multiple between the seed and the A were, you know, lower than historically, but it's something around 1.5 to 3 times, you know, the previous valuation. So to your point, you know, if on average, you should actually take that money and have more runway.
Makes sense. And I think that's a sensible, I don't know, at least insight for the founders in the audience is like the market is active, right? Like, don't just wait for a better future that might come or might not come or might take 4 quarters, right? So thanks. That makes sense. So linked to that, to still do fundraising, let's get into the metrics, if you want, discussion. Again, it depends on the business, it's relative. Sometimes, I mean, you have first-time founders raising a Series A for maybe a prize round for the very first, and they're like, hey, Tommy, I heard that after I hit 1 million in ARR or 2 million in ARR, whatever, I'm there. And the answer is no, right? The answer is depends on your company and your business model and your margins probably at that stage maybe. But in terms of from your perspective, from your funds, if you can share a little bit about what metrics do you look at, that'd be, I think, quite insightful for the audience.
Yeah, there's many things. And as you said, it certainly varies by model and even just within the fintech universe, which is what we work in, right? But besides ARR or revenue, right, which obviously is the number one thing. I mean, today, yes. I mean, I think for a company that has less than 1 million of ARR, broadly speaking, right, unlikely that a Series A will happen. Where that number sits between 1 and 5, so to speak, right, can be largely variable. So maybe to speak about some other things that I would look at, right? I think certainly the team, but not only the founding team, also the next level, right? Like the actual hires that have been made to run an operation that can scale and do so quickly. That is always important, I think today more so than ever. I think I also look at, I mean, in Latin America, right, fintech, I think distribution advantages are always very important, right? So to what degree the team has secured those, and again, of course, depends on the model, to what degree those have been secured through exclusivity agreements or other types of partnerships is always quite interesting. And I think ideally, right, for a Series A at this point, I would like to see commercial traction to the point that hopefully there's also some level of diversification in the customers that the company has, right? Especially for B2B2C models, I would say. I think that's something that I would look for these days.
Interesting. Thanks. Juan?
Yeah, look, I mean, at Series A, you want to see some reduction in risk, right? So that's what we're looking for. And so part of that's measured by revenue. But again, not all revenue is equal, right? So who are the customers? How diversified is their customer base? Is it a recurring revenue stream versus a one-time revenue stream? So there's a lot of things that we look at from that perspective. Obviously, team, market opportunity, market size, all these things are things that we look at. So there's not one metric that we really say, this tells us that this is a ready for Series A. So it's very unique to each company in some ways. But I do think we want to really see the difference from a seed perspective where you give or a pre-seed, it could be a PowerPoint slide, right? So it's all promise. Here you want to see some execution. Here you want to see that this really has the trajectory that we want to see, and that if you put money, that will actually show the growth that you want to see, and hopefully in an exponential manner. And so I think that's fundamentally what we're looking for. What the metrics specifically are, there's not one set of metrics, and it's very different by whether it's a SaaS-based company, whether it's an education company, a healthcare company, because we're a generalist firms, right? So I can't say that there's one metric that we necessarily look at only, but it's a broad-based approach that we look at.
Perfect. Marcos, you don't lead Series A's, but you help your companies get there, right? So how do you think about that?
Yeah, I'm just watching the Series A's, you know, happening. We had almost 80 Series A's already within, you know, since we started 6 years ago. So what I can share maybe, you know, in terms of data, is that there is no correlation, you know, between traction and Series A happening. That's a learning. you know, even if you strip out 21, so it's not that, you know, in the bull market, everything's what's happening. Actually, before 21, there was no correlation. So to your point, I totally agree. I believe the investors, they want to see if you're a founder, if you're onto something. So if you found a interesting go-to-market strategy, or if you have a very interesting team, or, you know, if your economics, you know, seem, you know, interesting, and if you scale, you know, it can be something. So I believe it's much, much more about that. And I would argue that what we are seeing in the backstage is when the question is traction, probably is because the investors are not convinced about those other things, you know, about the opportunity, about, you know, the quality of the team, about, you know, the size of the market, and so on and so forth. So my point here is, in the Series A, it's still about, I totally agree that, you know, it's not our point, but it is still about the founders and what they are seeing. So you as a founder, you should understand that if you are onto something, the funds themselves should be the ones asking to invest and not the other way around. So if it's the other way around, probably it's because they're not convinced about, you know, what you're building.
But one other thing I would add to that, though, so just to add about the founders, though, I think it's important, just small advice to founders, is really understand what is driving your business. You're in the weeds all the time, and so it's sometimes hard for you to pull out, especially at this stage of Series A, because so much is happening. But you really need to be able to pull out and say, okay, what are the true metrics that are driving my business, and be able to explain that very clearly. Because if you can't explain that, it's going to be very hard for an investor to say, yeah, I want to follow you. The other thing that's important for us also, as we see, is you want founders who can also fundraise, not this round, but the next round. And so you need to be able to prove that you have that ability to explain your business and also be able to explain it broadly to somebody who may not understand your sector or something like that, but explain why you're really solving a critical problem and you have that traction. And that's something that you find that Series A founders don't think about sometimes. And so I think that's a critical piece, because you're not, for us, if we're investing, we're not investing for this round. We're investing for the long term, right?
I think that's a good insight. Yeah, we'll talk about growth rounds in a bit. But so what you're saying is, for Series A, metrics matter. They might matter more than in some cases than others, but the fundraising, storytelling, fundraising capabilities of the founders also matters at that point, especially in LATAM with a more shallow capital market structure in a way. Makes sense. Thank you. The next question, I mean, we just had Pomelo and Foodology and Behab talking about product market fit and how it's different maybe in a B2C and a B2B business. Product market fit, again, this mysterious concept that many people define in different ways. We can spend hours or seconds talking about it. But I think if you, any of you have a perspective in terms of how you think about it, again, it depends, it depends per business, but are you looking at retention? Are you looking at the possibility of scaling that revenue? How do you look at it?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I think, I forget who it was, but someone defined product market fit as when the market is ripping the product out of your hands, right? Or when you cannot meet the amount of demand. I think the degree to which that becomes an economic reality, or how that's manifested in terms of economics, is always interesting, right? I mean, it's definitely variable. But yes, I think I would definitely look at retention. I think the recurrence of revenue, as I think Antoine was mentioning before, because not all revenue types are equal, right? Is definitely something we look at as well. I think, you know, for certain models, definitely the amount of churn is important. You know, the effect of seasonality on the business and how the business can navigate through that in an effective manner is also something I would look at. So those are some things, but it truly is a broad concept, which takes us back to the conversation about funding rounds. At the end of the day, just a quick comment. I think any round of funding, if you can, for some advice to the founder, the more competitive tension that you can create, probably the better and faster that the round will move, right? It's just a reality of supply and demand.
Good to hear a Series A investor mentioning that. Yeah, of course, we talk about it a lot at Latitude, but yeah, that's a good point. It's also about the context too. Sorry, Antoine.
No, I was just saying Carlos is playing against us on all his comments here, but you know, I think product market fit, as you said, is a broad term. I think fundamentally, do people want to pay for your product, or is there a fundamental way to make revenue from your product? And I think there are a lot of products out there that are great, but people don't want to pay for them. It's very hard to make a business. Now, there are some products that, as long as they're in people's hands, there are ways to monetize them in secondary manners. I mean, I worked at Google for a number of years, and search to begin with didn't make money, right? But afterwards, you added AdWords and you added ads all around it, and that made money. And so the search product got a lot of usage and then you monetized afterwards. So that's a very good example of that. But that's not easy to make happen. And sometimes I think founders overassume the ability to do that. So I think really finding that product that somebody, if you can get them to rip it out of your hands, you've won, right? But that point, but that's another rarity. So I think finding something that people really are willing to pay, it's solving a pain point that people are clear about and that you can find a monetary model that really works, I think is something that's critical.
Not so much to add here, but people say that normally you know when you found, so it's and it depends on the company. So we saw that happening with Caju, which were Investors Together, or with Buzzer, or Cayena here in Sao Paulo, or Cobra in Colombia. And it depends, because some of that of those companies are B2C, the others are B2B and software and servers, or consumer. But the point is, when your clients actually getting your product in a positive economics since the beginning, and you don't need to invest so much in marketing, and actually it's the opposite. What we saw in those companies that they were actually reducing the investment because they really wanted to deliver a very good experience to their clients. So it's kind of the opposite direction.
Makes sense. One thing I'll say, but when you mention marketing, I think one of the concerns, what worries me sometimes is if you see that a model is only growing because they increase their marketing spend, that's a model that really concerns me, because then you're really at the mercy of just continuing to spend and spend and spend. And that doesn't tell you that your customers are coming back to you naturally. And that's a very concerning.
That's a good point. Yeah, getting that granularity into PMF. I was reading recently a good study from Lenny Raczynski about, he interviewed a ton of growth founders about PMF, product market fit, and many of them showed that they found it in different stages, different moments. It wasn't one moment, but especially hitting it in different customer segments, not the initial ICP, but then in subsequent ones. Quick question, Marcos, you just said even stripping out 2021, you saw teams raising Series A's without the metric. So the rule of thumb idea that you raise a Series A with a pro market fit, in your opinion, it's not always true, right? If I can extrapolate that.
Maybe signs of PMF, but it's different from traction, right? So that, talk about ARR and so on, I believe it's not that case. So that's my point.
Makes sense. Cool. Let's get into it. I think here we'll also have good perspectives, but one of the main challenges, if you want, of the BC industry as such in Latin America is challenges, and I would say ways where we need to grow in the next decade, hopefully, is the question about how deep are the markets when we get into growth stages after Series Bs and eventually liquidity events, right? Of course, in the current market, we've seen some global growth investors pulling back. We've seen some new ones, but I would love to get your perspectives. Maybe you, not only from FinTech Collective perspective, but also in terms of just being around other US funds in New York or in the Bay Area. Maybe how do you look at that in terms of who invests after you when you come into a Series A in Latin America?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, well, I would say that the first thing is that I think overall the amount of players native to the region that are entering the growth stages or specializing in it, obviously Bicycle being a very clear example, right, is increasing, and I'm confident that it will continue to increase. I think that, I mean, when you look at the fundamentals, and I think the guys at Atlantico put it in very good perspective, right? Like, what is it? LATAM far exceeds other emerging markets, right? If you take that comparative stance, right, in terms of the number of exits, M&A and IPOs relative to the amount of venture dollars that have been invested. At the same time, the tech as percentage of GDP for LATAM is inferior to clearly developed markets, but even other emerging markets like India, right, which I think is a very relevant comparison. So I think that bodes fundamental. And you have a very robust pipeline of companies that are well positioned to grow once they receive growth funding based on maybe the signs of product market fit, to put in those terms that they have exhibited, right? So if you put that picture in context, yes, I mean, I think when more money is injected, there is good reason to believe that things can grow and that the picture can look better, right?
But yeah, when more money is injected, that's a question. What do you think, Anton, there? Like, do you see global capital allocators coming more deeply into LATAM in the next decade?
Well, look, I think if you step back from a macro perspective, there's a lot of money that went to China. The global political situation between the US and China is clearly not good, and I don't think it's going to get better anytime soon. As a result, and that's actually preventing some investments in China from the US, I believe. And so I think that they, you know, a lot of investors are now, from a global perspective, if you're looking outside of the US, outside of Europe, they're saying it's India and it's Brazil. And so I do think that there will be a focus and there will be funding. Will it be 2021? No. I think it's still cautious, just like all of us are more cautious. But I think there will be more funding coming to Latin America as a result. I think Brazil is on the map. I mean, when we first started 11 years ago, we even in Brazil, we had to convince people that Brazil was a good market to do tech investing, right?
Especially Brazil.
Especially Brazil, right? I mean, we've gone through ups and downs, but look, I think Brazil's on the map. It's clear. And if you look at it, if you're outside of Brazil, you hear it, it's brought up all the time. People think that things are really changing in Brazil and things are, you know, there's a market here, there's opportunity here. So I do think that for the next 5 to 10 years, yes, I think Brazil is going to be on the map. I think there's going to be more money here from a later stage. I mean, we also have an opportunity fund and we invest later stage. Yeah. But I do think that there will be a focus on Latin America and Brazil. And I do think that it will be there. But I do, again, it will be more measured, I think, than it was in 2021, which I think, frankly, is a good thing for all of us and a good thing for the markets.
I totally agree. And I just a funny story. When we started, you know, the first fund in 16, it took us, and we raised the first fund basically with Brazilian investors. We had something around 600 meetings to convince people. And the main recurrent argument that I would hear was that there were no entrepreneurs in Latin America. There wasn't, you know, the same thing that I, you know, kept hearing, which is, you know, crazy. You know, I heard that 70% of the attendance here is, you know, entrepreneurs. So it's crazy to think that. But then, you know, to your point, I totally agree with you guys. We're seeing actually a growing interest of, you know, growth U.S. and also global funds regarding the region. There is a narrative that, you know, after SoftBank stopped investing, you know, there's no growth, you know, money here and so on and so forth. What we are seeing is actually the opposite. The number, I'm not sure if the dollar amount is going to be the same, but the number of funds for the founders to raise money from, I would bet that it's going to be way, way higher starting next year. That's my view, just because we are seeing in the field the funds are actually, you know, asking us for introductions to companies. So we're seeing, and when we started Canary, it was the other way around. I used to go to the U.S. to tell about, you know, the ecosystem here, and now it's happening the opposite. You know, the funds are actually calling us. You know, large funds like TCV or even Tiger, or, you know, guys from FightDeck. You know, and so we're seeing more and more funds coming to the region,
and they're actually visiting, which is good.
Visiting, they're not here.
Calling and doing VCs. Yeah.
I was going to say, sorry, very quick. I mean, from a very practical perspective, as you know, as a fund that invests globally, the fact that, you know, I was able to fly out last night and be here this morning and be here right now with a 1 hour time difference makes a difference.
You still got here before Marcos got here. Yeah.
Yeah. Incredible, right?
I was riding my motorbike.
but seriously, I mean, I think when you're investing in early stages and even at growth, right? Like when you're venture capital, at the end of the day, I think it's more a game of it's more a game of psychology, arguably, than it is about finance in several respects. Meeting people face to face, spending time with the teams makes a difference, at least for me, and I'm sure they would agree. I've met plenty of founding teams that, after interacting with them and truly spending time in person, it made a difference. If you're a US-based growth investor and you're trying to invest in Southeast Asia, yeah, the opportunity there is very, very interesting, but you're gonna have to fly for what, like 15, 20 hours to get there, right? It does make a difference. You need to set up local teams. Logistically, it's more complex.
Plus the tailwinds in terms of nearshoring with Mexico and Latam eventually. That makes sense. Cool. I have time for two questions, I think. One and a half. Quickly, there's a lot of founders, also some emerging fund managers or people bringing into VC. More personal question. I mean, what lights you up in this job? What makes you excited waking up in the morning? Maybe share a case if you want quickly. In terms of people wanting to do this job of being a venture capitalist. Start, Carlos.
Sure. I think at the end of the day, it's a privilege to be able to meet people that are doing something that's fundamentally masochistic in the spirit of improving improving the status quo, right? There's nothing harder than being a founder, right? I was on the other side of the table before I became an investor, and I fully appreciate that. So I think we have the luxury of being able to meet these teams and track with them, and at the end of the day, be able to choose in a region, in the region that invented magical realism, right? Where there's always plenty of surprises, and sometimes that can be massively frustrating. But honestly, like the upside to be surprised and amazed is wonderful, right? So it's pretty special.
I couldn't agree more. I think the ability to every day see new and interesting models that someone's coming up with, working with very bright people, entrepreneurs who much smarter than I am, who come up with great ideas and have the perseverance to fight for years to make it successful. I mean, my personal favorite story is working with Cesar from Gympass, you know, invested with him 10 years ago. And just, you know, I remember the first meeting we had, which was in a little cafe with him and his two founders, trying to explain to me what Gympass was going to be and moving from a B2C model to a B2B model. And then, you know, 10 years later, they're a global company, you know. So we're inspiring. It's an amazing ride to be just a part of and be, you know, have the, have, you know, just be lucky enough to be with them. And I think that's what I enjoy. It's really, you know, and not every story is like that, but we try to help every company as much as we can. And, you know, every founder, you know, we believe that we work with has the best intentions. Things don't always work out, but you're still working with amazing people. I think that's, you know, it's a privilege, honestly.
Actually, for me, it's like, it's my life project. So I, you know, I left the hedge fund industry, and I, you know, I had a blessing to have the opportunity to think, you know, what's next, what to do next with my life. And my main goal was to be, you know, part of something that could at least help foster entrepreneurship, you know, here in the region. I really believe that, you know, the private markets, you know, and companies being built can actually foster the growth of the region. So that's why I'm, you know, connected totally with that. And in the kind of a personal story, Guppy, which we are also involved, you know, we invested brand in the very early stages when we were just the founders trying to sell, you know, the first customers. And now it's, they are like the largest company in their field. And it's amazing to see that.
And I think Brian will be sharing his own story in a bit, Brian Reckworth. And it's about that, seeing someone building something from scratch, something that didn't exist. And then 10 years after, is a global juggernaut like Gympass. Well, less than a minute each. Something, one space this is that you're excited about in LATAM, especially whether that's in AI or anything else. 1 minute each, something you're excited about.
Sure. So, yeah, definitely excited about the application of AI, for example, as it relates to the CFO stack. I think there's very interesting things, and I think that definitely the competitive landscape there is going to broaden. But I fundamentally, in fintech, right, which is what we do, I continue to be very excited about the opportunity to digitize verticals in the real economy that are old school, for lack of better words, and where you can arguably lead in, you know, with a software product as a wedge, and then potentially, probably, you know, most realistically monetize on financial services on top of that, right? And then in some of these models, I think, yeah, you can also monetize the software layer significantly, and others is going to be primarily the financial services. But I think, you know, at least when it comes to fintech, I mean, the reality is that I think the main pain point in the region is still fundamentally access to credit in many ways. And I think that doing so in a way that can disrupt verticals across the region is very interesting.
Look, I mean, I think AI is going to be fascinating, but I think for me, I see it more as a horizontal than a vertical, to be honest with you, because I think every company needs to think about how it can impact their business and make them more efficient and effective. For me, I'm focusing a lot more now on climate. I do think there is climate. I think there is a global imperative that we have to address at this point. I mean, hopefully we all realize that. And I think for Latin America, and especially Brazil, it's a massive opportunity, and I think it's the right time. And I think there's a Brazil Climate Summit in New York a couple of weeks ago, which I think was very well done with Colombia. And I think we're going to see a lot of technology being built around the world, Europe, US, and I think there's a lot of government incentives that are happening now, which is actually helpful. Yeah. But I do think that bringing those to a market like Brazil is a very interesting time.
I would say that, you know, one thing that I'm very excited to see founders building is something on top of the PIX rails here in Brazil, but not talking about fintech. We're seeing, you know, lots of very interesting things on the fintech side. And my point here is we have one of the most connected populations globally, and now, and everyone is in WhatsApp and everyone is connected, but now they can transact in a very low cost. So you can actually sell a service or a product for, let's say, $1 or less than $1 for free in terms of transaction cost. So maybe what can you think about that you can serve the lower part of the pyramid with those, you know, cheaper, let's say, services and products now that, you know, people are connected?
Very cool. Thank you so much to Canary, Balor, and FinTech Collective for being here. It's been a pleasure, and hopefully, yeah, we'll be here in 10 years telling even better stories. But I appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Latitude Podcast. Subscribe wherever you listen to your podcast for more talks with great founders and investors. I'm your host, Brian Reckworth. Vamos Latam. See you next week.